September 14th, 2004, I'm talking with Jerry Young at his home on Penn Avenue. And Jerry, could you state your full name for us?
Sure. Gerald Edward Young, and I normally go by Jerry. Well, Gerald with a G and Jerry with a J, just to confuse people.
And where were you born and when?
I was born in on December the 7th, 1932, at the old Grand Ronde Hospital in LeGrand. And it was a cold winter night, my parents told me. In fact, I think it was like 20 below. And so my mother remembers that birth date distinctly, not only because of my birth, but because of the cold temperature.
Would you give your parents' names?
My mother is Lola Sarah Banton Young, and my father was Frank Edward Young, and they were married in 1931, in October of 1931.
Had they grown up in LeGrand?
They were both born in LeGrand. My mother is a third generation person. Her grandfather had arrived in, grandfather Ed Banton had arrived in this valley by 1866 because my mother's father, William Banton, was born here in 1866 at a place called Lone Pine, which became famous in the 1940s when three high school boys cut it down. Lone Pine was actually located out not towards Union, and not too far from the road that turns off to the airport, a little bit this side. And so she was born in 1910 here, actually in LeGrand, in a home, in a relative's home. And my father was born here in 1898 and grew up on the river across from Riverside Park. His father had arrived in the valley by 1870 because he chose in the 1870 census in Somerville. And I'm not sure when my father's mother arrived in the valley, but she arrived in time to marry my grandfather, Henry Young, in 1880. And so my dad was the next to last of about eight children.
What do you remember about your parents or even your grandparents talking about their early lives?
Well, I've always regretted not having been more interested as a young person in talking to them about their early lives. It seems like you have to get quite a little bit older to become interested in that sort of thing. And I did not know my grandfather Young. He died 4 years before I was born, and I didn't visit a lot with my grandmother Young. I saw her every once in a while, but she died when I was 6 years old, and so I think I was just kind of a little kid that was in the background with big eyes and kind of listening to conversation. So we never talked much about the early days and about coming across in a covered wagon or anything like that. Both of my grandparents, Banton and my grandmother Banton, her maiden name was
Banton, B-A-N-T-O-N.
And my grandmother was a McCauley before that, M-C-C-A-U. L-L-E-Y, and so they came across in covered wagons, she came across in the 1870s, I guess it was, but anyway, they didn't talk much about it either, to me. I do remember family history stories saying something about that they really, when she came across, this would be grandmother McCauley Banton, that they really didn't have any problems with Indians, for example. They had one scare, something like that, but they didn't really see any Indians coming across. Of course, my grandfather Banton was born here, and so he didn't have any Oregon Trail experiences. His parents did. His father, Ed Banton, actually proved up on some land on the Umpqua River in 1855, and I have a record of that. And then, like a lot of pioneers, those people mostly went through the Grand Ronde Valley on to paradise utopia of the Willamette Valley, and discovered then that they had gone through a valley they really would enjoy and came back here. So, and there were a lot of pioneers that did that. That's why this valley wasn't settled until 1862, when the Oregon Trail occurred in 1843. So it took about 20 years for people to really begin to realize they kind of wanted to live here instead of in the Willamette Valley.
Mm-hmm. What about your parents? Did they talk to you at any length about their early childhood experiences?
Yes, they did. And my mother relates things like coming by horse and buggy. She grew up in Ladd Canyon, right at the mouth of the canyon. In fact, the rest stop at Ladd Canyon is on old Banton property. And she remembers coming to town in a horse and buggy, and they would follow essentially what we now today call the Foothill Road. And one spot in that road was pretty sidling, and her mother absolutely refused to ride across it. So her mother would insist on her dad stopping and letting her out, and sometimes the kids got out and sometimes they stayed in the buggy and they went around this sidling area. But it was actually following the old Oregon Trail up on the side hill, and that was there because it's sometimes the year it was too wet to follow the Oregon Trail that went out into the valley a ways, and that's all marsh area out there. It's now called Ladd Marsh, or parts of it are Ladd Marsh.
So could you define for me sidling? I'm not...
Sidling is, to me, that may be a Grand Ronde Valley term, sidling is means that it's angled, it's tippy. One side of the wagon is going to be much higher than the other side. Mm. And in those old farm wagons and buggies, they were very high off the ground, and the center of gravity was pretty high. And it didn't take too much of an angle for you to feel like it might tip over. So you just had to be very, very careful about that sort of thing. And so she didn't want to ride part of that. So they would do that and come to town. My mother told stories about when they came into town, they didn't have a lot of money, so they'd bring their own lunch. And there was a grocery store, and I could find out what the name of it is, I think. Probably it's in my mother's oral history book. But there's a grocery store that the owner had tables in the back, and he would let farm people, come in and go to the back room and have their lunch. And usually they'd buy something from him as part of the lunch, like some hot dogs or some pickles or something like that. So they had a place that they knew they could go to have lunch, their own lunch, and of course they'd stock up with supplies from that store, that grocery store, before they went back home.
Would this be in the teens, or was it earlier?
This would be in the 19-teens, say, mm-hmm. say 1915 to 1920, mm-hmm. but that would have occurred in the late 1800s, too.
Mm-hmm. What about your father? What about his young life?
Well, he grew up on the river, across from Riverside Park, as indicated earlier, and a young family had a small fruit orchard, and so that's how they made a living, was his dad peddled fruit locally. And they had apples and pears and apricots and peaches and plums and prunes and the typical fruit that could be grown in this valley. And he always enjoyed telling stories about canoeing on the river. At that time, the river was a little higher level. In later years, because of the gravel being pulled out down at Island City by a gravel company, it cut the channel down, and so you don't have the wide river and the ripples and things that they had in those days in the ponds. So they could canoe, especially in higher water, clear up into midsummer at least. They could canoe on the river right there at Riverside Park. And a lot of the grandkids would come down and canoe with them. They'd swim there. They'd jump off of the bridge there and swim. And they had a swimming hole. And they did all kinds of fun things on the water. They got very good at canoeing. They had one little canoe they called the Peanut. And it was a one-person canoe. And from pictures, I'd say it probably wasn't more than 5 or 6 feet long. It's very small. Whereas the normal canoes probably ran from 10 to 15 feet long. Some of them were pretty good size and would hold about four people. And so We have a lot of family pictures of the individuals in those canoes. Not a lot of, not all of them family members. Especially when the kids got up into their teenage years and their early 20s, they'd have friends in and they'd do that. My grandfather, Young, came from Ottawa, Canada. He was born in 1846, and he was he taught gymnasium or taught gym in Ottawa in his younger years, and so he was pretty athletic, and so he put up a lot of bars and parallel bars and swings and trapeze kinds of things in the trees there, a lot of cottonwoods there at the, this small acreage, probably, I'm just going to guess, 10 or 15 acres. And so the kids all learned to do trapeze kinds of things on there and do tricks on the parallel bars and, you know, whether it was chinning yourself or flipping on the bars or whatever, not unlike a lot of things you see in gymnastics today. And so he saw that his kids all learned to do that sort of thing, as well as swim very well, obviously, to play on the river and in the river. And so, you know, they just had a, they had an outdoor lifestyle, and they did a lot of traveling into the woods. They'd always go huckleberrying, things like this in the summertime, and camp out and that type of thing.
So where did they peddle the fruit?
They peddled the fruit around La Grande, and he would have people that would come out and knew that certain times of year certain fruit would be on, and they would come out for it. Or they would actually maybe write letters to him, or they would, no phones in those days, or they would let him know, you know, I want to know next year when you have apricots or when you have peaches or whatever. And so there would be those people. But also they put together fruit and in a way, in a small wagon, they would go up to Perry and Hillgard and Starkey and the logging camp up the river, Camp One area, and also they would go as far as Meacham and Camila. They'd go to Camila and then to Meacham.
In a truck?
In a wagon, a horse and wagon.
Oh, a horse and wagon.
Yeah, they'd have a team of horses in a small light wagon, more than a buggy, and they would actually stop along the way and peddle to whatever log cabins might be out there or other houses, and of course the homes that were in these different communities along the way. And so they would turn around and meet them and come back. And it would be, they'd camp out one night at least on the way up and one night on the way back. They can come back a lot faster because the horses are headed home and it's, a lot of it is downhill. And my dad remembers doing that as probably around, I'm just gonna guess, the period 1908 to 1914 was what he particularly remembered. At some point there, they quit doing it because automobiles came in and the train was going through and things, and so, but, you know, it, the opportunity to sell fruit kind of decreased in terms of peddling like that. And
did they pick the fruit? Did they pick the fruit themselves?
They picked the fruit themselves. They grew it and picked it themselves.
So it was just your grandfather and his
and
children?
His, and his children.
How many children did he have?
Oh, there were eight.
Of the pickers.
All good pickers. And we have pictures of them in the trees, you know, on ladders in the trees and things. And they seem to have a good time. And the kids, as they got old enough, time they got about 5 or 6 years old, they could at least pick from the ground. And so they pick it and they sort it. And they have certain, they have the different kinds of fruit at different times of the year and different qualities and different size. And so people would look forward to buying. And often people bought enough to can. They might buy 2 boxes of apples or 2 boxes of peaches or something like this.
So when the fruit ran out, what was the livelihood then?
Well, they were pretty dependent on the fruit, making enough money in the summer to take you through the year. He did raise a few head of cattle, and he raised chickens and some hogs and things like this, and a pretty good sized garden. But really the primary commercial the primary source of funds was the commercial fruit orchards. And so you just learn to save your money. And of course, when you have a small place like that and you have all the animals and all the fruit and you raise the vegetable garden and things, you don't really have to buy a lot of things. You got clothing you buy, you got things like coffee and sugar and salt, but they didn't have to buy a lot of things. So they got by without a lot of money. Well, it's kind of interesting. I don't know really how well he did, but I do know that he made enough money, my grandfather Young, to see that his daughters all got to go to college. And in fact, he insisted on that. His philosophy was that it was much more difficult for women to make their way in the world than it was for men. There were jobs for men, but there weren't that many jobs for women. And he wanted all of his daughters to be very successful professionally. So he made sure that they all got to go to the university. And in fact, most of them attended Whitman and graduated from Whitman. And in fact, most of them majored in music. So I have a picture of one of my aunts, Bertha, who was on the Whitman basketball team about 1901. And so I don't know that others were involved in athletics over there, but all the women went to Whitman. And I think I've been going to check to see if all of them graduated or not. But I know that one of them went on, Bertha, the one who was at Whitman in 1901, went on to play the violin very successfully and was actually a member of the Seattle Symphony at one time. She actually studied violin in Germany before the First World War. Another one of those of my dad's sisters, Harriet, also attended Whitman, was a very good music player and went on to study piano in Germany, and in fact got out of Germany right at the beginning of the First World War and had to come back by ship after the war had essentially begun. Another aunt, Sadie, who married Carl Engdahl, who became a state senator in Pentland for a number of years, was also a very good musician and taught piano in Pentland out of her home quite a bit. And she was quite a good pianist. One other one really stayed at home. In fact, one of them died fairly young, I think, probably in her teens or something like that. So I guess she did go to Whitman.
Mm-hmm. What did your dad do?
Well, my dad, and actually all the brothers had some college experience, or some post-high school. All of them graduated from high school. All of the young kids graduated from high school, which is kind of unusual because we all graduated by 1920. Hmm. They had all graduated from high school. In those days, for all the kids graduating from high school, my numbers may not be quite right because there's one daughter that died fairly early. But anyway, all the boys went on to some post-high school experience. Two of them went to Oregon State for about a year or two. But my dad decided what he wanted to do was to learn about automotive mechanics. So right after the First World War, and in fact, he got drafted and he was essentially had his bag packed and was on the way to the train station when the war was over with, and they said he didn't have to go. That's how close he came to being in the First World War. He decided he wanted to go to learn automotive mechanics, so he went to an automotive school in Los Angeles around, I'd say, 1918, somewhere in 1918 to 1920. Mm-hmm. He never did it as a profession, but it always served him well because he was a rancher, farmer, fruit grower his whole life.
So when he came back from Los Angeles, what did he do?
Well, when he came back, he actually then bought out his brother, Fred, had an ice business in LaGrande. And my dad bought out Fred, and he began running an ice business then along in the early 20s somewhere. And had that business for over 10 years.
Describe the ice business in the 20s.
Well, the ice business in the 20s would mean that for him, they put up ice by running Grand Ronde River water into a pond on their family, the home property of the family. And in the wintertime then, when you run the water into this pond, it starts freezing, and in those days we had colder winters and it would freeze more. They would then, when the water would freeze and then if snow fell on it, they'd go out and scrape the snow off and then flood the top of the water of the ice with a little more water, because if you can only freeze ice down about you know, around here maybe it gets 6 or 8 inches deep. So you don't get thick ice by letting it freeze down. You get thick ice by letting some of it freeze, running water on top of the frozen ice, and freeze it on top of the already frozen water. So you run another inch of water on top, let it freeze, run another inch of water on top, let it freeze, and you can build up maybe 12-inch blocks of ice that way. And you do want to scrape the snow off between before you flood it, or it tends to make the ice kind of be more porous, not be as solid, so you don't have as much cooling effect for the same volume. And so you just get more solid, dense ice if you do it that way. And so that's how they did it. Then at the right time of year, this is probably, say, late January or something like this, when things are going to start warming up a little bit, you go out, they actually take a horse out on the ice, and they use a horse to pull a little device that marks the blocks. You pull them one way so you have parallel lines, and it digs down in enough to scrape out a little ice. You pull the horse the other way, and so you mark out your blocks, and then you saw it with a handsaw, an ice saw. An ice saw would look somewhat like a one-man crosscut saw that would be used even today in the timber industry. Well, or would have been used 30, 40 years ago before chainsaws. And I suppose today, if you were to do it the same way, you'd be out there with a chainsaw cutting the ice. And they cut those blocks into probably about 100-pound blocks, and they'd use a horse then to hook, they have ice tongs, hook onto them, get them up onto the old, onto the ice, out of the water, onto the ice, use a horse to pull it over to a chute, and they would actually get pull it up the chute with a horse on the other, a cable hooked to it and running through the ice house, and a horse on the other side of the ice house, and the horse would pull it up that way. Not unlike you would, we put up hay in barns up in, into the 1950s when what you put loose hay in the barns.
Huh, what did an ice house look like?
Well, an ice house would have been any building that you essentially had a sawdust, a floor with sawdust insulation underneath, because ground temperature is about 57 degrees around here, Fahrenheit. And so you want the insulated from the ground too, or it melts the ice. And then it has thick walls, and it walls could be, you know, I suppose it could be anything from 10 inches thick to maybe, you know, 20 inches thick, depending on how they wanted, how much they wanted to insulate it. And they fill those walls with sawdust. So you'd have an inside wall and an outside wall, and then you fill it with sawdust because that's the insulation that they, inexpensive insulation they had available to them. Nowadays they would use, you know, rock wall or fiberglass or something like that, or polystyrene, even better. Okay, but they'd have sawdust in the walls, and so you'd just put the ice in there and stack it up, and then you'd put some sawdust on the ice each layer so the ice wouldn't freeze together completely. So you kind of went in and knocked it. You could break it out in those chunks that you had cut it out of the ice pond with. And so you'd store it that way, and you maybe would have, you know, you might put up 200 tons of ice or something like that, depending on the building and how much you thought you could sell. And people did that for themselves, too. There were families that had ice houses that were small. Might be a room 10 by 12 feet, and they might have 6 feet of ice in there or something, you know. Didn't need to be big, but where they were doing it commercially, they had a pretty good-sized building. I can remember the building as a kid. It was still there, and they still, I remember them putting up ice, but, you know, it's very, very vague. And I don't know how much of it is my memories mixed with what I've been told. Oral history, but I do have a very strong vision of that, so I'm pretty sure that I did see it going on. And they get quite a few people to help them. It might take a team of 10 people to put up ice and do it efficiently.
So they do it in the winter and then sell it in the summer?
Sell it, and then they would start marketing it, because people had, they have coolers in their homes, and often coolers that were exposed to the outside with a screen over it so the flies couldn't get in. But in cooler weather, they just put things in, the things that they wanted to keep cool, they put into that. They'd have to worry about things freezing in the wintertime, too. But anyway, that's how they kept things cool. They figured out how to do it to not cause things to freeze, but be cold enough. But in the summertime, maybe starting in April or May, then from, say, 1st of May to the 1st of October, something was the ice season, and that's when you sold ice. And you would take orders for ice. And you'd have your standard customers, and you'd have an ice route, and you probably had two wagons at least, two ice wagons, going around town, stopping
I think horse-driven,
and to a team of horses on each wagon, and one fellow running it, and you go around town delivering the ice on this route. And you'd probably have to, you knew kind of how often you had to check an ice box, depending partly on how big a chunk, how big an ice box they had and how big a chunk of ice they bought. And you'd make your rounds and look at the ice box and see if it needed to be replaced or not, and then go on. You'd have the team trained so that you never had to get on the wagon. You just tell the team to pull up, and they know where to go to stop at the next house. And you'd be in the back, you'd be then going at the back of the wagon and cutting. You might have a 100-pound block, and you know this house needs a 50-pound, so you'd chip it with an ice pick and break it in two and take the 50-pound chunk in and put it in the ice box. Now, people often wouldn't be at home, so you solved that by having a selling them a coupon book. I have those today that are from that ice business, and the coupon book would have 5-cent coupons in it and 10-cent coupons, and I don't know whether it's 20-cent or 25-cent coupons or not, but there'd be a variety of coupons in there, and they just leave that laying on. It might cost them $5 for the coupon book, or $3, I don't know. We could look at one and find out. And they leave that on the top of the ice box. When the iceman came, they go to the back door, always unlocked. They go in, check the ice box, decide how much is needed, put it in the ice box, and tear out the appropriate number of coupons to pay for the ice. And then they go to the next house. Wow. So that's kind of how the ice business went. Then by 1935, he knew by 1930 that he was not, you know, the ice business wasn't going to go on forever because electricity was coming in, electric refrigerators were being invented, things like this. In fact, he started selling electric refrigerators before he went out of the ice business as a way to transition into the new technology. But by 1935, by about 1932, when I was born, he'd already decided that business wasn't going to go on forever. And he didn't want to really become a refrigerator person. And so he then bought land out in Mount Glen, about 6-7 miles north of LeGrand. And he and an uncle of mine, Johnny, or Cecil, we called him Johnny, planted a fruit orchard out there, anticipating then that by about 1938 or 39, things would begin to be produce fruit, and then they wouldn't have to depend upon some other source of income. And in fact, they raised foxes out in the Mount Glen area for about 5 or 6 years.
Foxes.
You know, you've heard of mink farms?
Yeah.
They were fox farms. And they raised foxes up in the timber. There was about, the 90 acres they had, probably about 30 acres of it was timber. And they actually raised foxes. I don't remember. They called silver tips, and I think there was a sort of a bluish fox. But they raised foxes, and you would then, you had your breeding group, and they would have these little foxes. I don't remember whether kits was the right name for foxes or whether that's the name used for mink. I guess that's mink. But anyway, they raised foxes, and then you would kill them and skin them, and you would kill them with carbon monoxide. And you know, it's not an approved way today, but that's those days. And you would skin them, and you would treat the hides, and then people would, buyers would actually come through LeGrand and buy those fox furs.
Wow.
And they would take them away, and they would tan them, and they would then sell them to somebody who would sew them into to apparel.
So how did they get the first pair of foxes?
You'd buy breeding stock from other people that were already doing it.
In the valley, or did they have to go?
Well, you probably went outside the valley to do it. Hmm. I don't, but once there were several fox farms in the valley, and there were some out in Somerville. Yeah. This would probably be in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And actually, mink then became more valuable to raise rather than foxes because the furs were so much more valuable. And so there were mink farms in this valley into the 60s at least, if not into the 70s.
Remember the foxes? Do you remember?
Yeah, oh yeah, I remember going up there because we had foxes until I was probably 8 years old, say 1940, 41, somewhere along in there. And I remember going up and even helping skin a little bit. I wasn't very good at it, but I had my pocket knife and I had the skinning. And they'd hire people and men that were out of work in La Grande to come out and help with skinning the foxes out. And they'd have to stretch the hides over a board. They had a special panel board that you made, that they had, that you'd stretch the hide over that to stretch it out to dry, and you put it out to dry, and then you'd sell it. Then after it was dry, you'd take it off of this special board, and there's a name for it that I've forgotten. Then the buyer would come through and check the quality of your furs and offer you a price. And
so did they have them in cages? How
they
had
them in fox pens.
What's a fox?
And a fox pen would have been something, I'm just guessing now, but I'd say it was probably 10 by 15 or 20 feet, and they'd have one female fox in each one. I don't remember whether they'd have more than one female in a pen or not, because there'd be a certain amount of problem with fighting. And you'd have to turn the males in with the females at certain times of the year. You'd have to run all that. And then they'd have then one or more families of foxes in each pen. And so you had a whole row of pens, and you could go down, and it would be made with what we call chicken wire today. And so it would go up about 6-7 feet high, but there'd also be a top on it, so they couldn't climb up and get out the top too.
Mm-hmm.
And a gate in it, and you'd go down a row of these pens with pens on each side of you, and your alleyway would also be fenced in. If a fox got out on you, they'd just get into the alleyway. So you always had sort of a double gate pulled or something. And how do you get that? They would then, sometimes they were always dead when they went and got it, you know, would die and they would be called. People around the valley knew who the fox farmers were, and they'd call them when they had an animal they wanted to get rid of, because it was either that or they'd have to bury it. And so they would go pick up this horse, for example, and then they would have to butcher the horse out, and they would then feed every bit of the horse to the foxes. Of course, all of it, you'd cut up the meat, but the bones you'd actually grind up, because the foxes needed, they knew in terms of nutrition, the foxes needed a certain amount of bone too. So you had a bone grinder in the fox feed house. You ground up the bone with a certain amount of the meat, and so you kind of knew the recipe that you wanted to use based on the experience of other fox growers. So you'd have to learn from somebody else. You could probably do some reading on it too.
What did a bone grinder look like?
Well, it looked like these. You see these hand grinders today that you can grind sausage in at home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it would look like that, except it would be about 6 or 8 times as big, and it would be powered probably with a little gasoline engine, and it would be very sturdy and durable. And so you could drop a bone that was, you know, 2 inches across in there. It'd be like a kind of like a miniature rock crusher is what it amounted to. Mm-hmm. It would break it up, and I don't recall whether they had 2 stages, you know, grind up big, you know, break it down into big chunks and break it down more. I don't remember. But I do remember the bone grinder.
Hmm.
And
was it loud?
It made a lot of noise, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, quite a little bit. And it would have as I remember, they had a little one, what we call a one-lung engine on it, one-cylinder engine. And you've probably heard those engines run. They go kind of ka-bang, ka-bang, and it's just, it fires every time that it loses, the flywheel slows down a certain amount and it'll cause it to fire again. And so you've probably heard one-cylinder engines run. Some parades around here will have one on a trailer now. And you might even hear it on a vehicle. Some of them still have some vehicles that have those, what we call one-lunger engines, one-cylinder engines. Like I always kind of wanted to get one. In fact, my brother Dale, I think, still has one out at the ranch. He lives on the fruit orchard, the one that my parents started in 1935. We moved there in 1935, and my brother Dale and his wife Peggy still live there on that ranch. And I think he still has one or two of those engines out there. We used one of those on a spray rig, and we used one of them on a what we call a saw rig, because we sawed our own firewood. But I guess I've completed maybe the fox story. They went out of business, and well, the Second World War came along. My uncle was drafted into the army, and he was in his 40s. He was probably 41, 42 when he was drafted.
Wow.
And he had been working in the, he had gone down to help out in the shipyards at the Kaiser, to build ships in Portland. And Kaiser, Henry Kaiser was building Liberty ships in Portland. And so he and my dad decided, well, he probably should go down there and help out that way, thinking he was probably too old for the Army. But they decided they needed men, and so they drafted him into the Army in the, I'm just going to guess, 1942, 43. And so he left the shipyards and was in fact, he was in on the invasion, the first invasion of Africa.
Mm.
And then ended up being discharged before they ever moved into Italy and Sicily and Normandy.
But your father,
because he was
too
old.
Your father escaped the draft?
And he actually escaped the draft because he just almost got taken in the First World War because he was the right age and just turned 18, got out of high school and was drafted. And then by the time the Second World War turned around, he was into his, he's into his mid-40s, and he had a family, and he was a farmer, and he was raising fruit and stuff. And so they mostly left people on the farms as much as they could because they had to worry about the food supply, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only one to run the ranch, so they weren't about to draft people where they were, whether it was grain or whether it was in the Midwest or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
So he just happened in be in that period of time when he didn't have to go into the service.
Hmm. So did your family move to Mount Glen then in the mid-30s?
In 1935. Mm-hmm. And they lived, I can still remember, and the house is still there on S Avenue in LeGrand where I went from the hospital home to. And I can remember that just a little bit. I think I could still draw the floor plan to that house and it might be fairly accurate, but I haven't been in the house, I don't believe, since 1935.
Hmm. What, do you remember the street number? Or on
no, but it was about a half a block west of Spruce Street, in between Greenwood and Spruce, and it was on the north side of the street, and it was kind of the middle house in that block.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I don't know the exact number, but I know where the house is.
So that's where the ice house was?
No, the ice house was down at the ranch, the farm, which was across from Riverside Park.
I see.
And if you go out Spruce Street towards the park, and after you go underneath the freeway, but before you get to the bridge, if you look off to the right back in the field, you'll see an old two-story red house back there. And you get to it by going along the access road that runs along the north side of the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you get to the house. In those days, you got to the house off of Spruce Street and a lane that went back down to that house. But you see a red house back there in the field, it looks old. That was actually built by my grandfather Young, and they in around 1880. He was married in 1880, and they lived. And at the time they were married, he ran the company store for the sawmill that was at Oradell, which is right at the mouth of the canyon here, where the river comes into the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a sawmill there, and there were and everything, and there was a company store there, and it was actually a spot where a lot of people stopped to buy things before they went over the mountain to Pendleton. And this would have been, he did that in the 1870s, late 1870s, and he did it up into the 1880s a little bit. I just know he's married in 1880, and I know he built the house maybe a year or two after that. And then he could plant the fruit orchard and begin to make his living selling fruit, and he could quit the job manager of the company store at Oradell Snodgrass was the name of the person that owned the mill and the store, Snodgrass, and that's a name that pops up in LeGrand. In fact, a descendant of that family is Russ Snodgrass, who retired a few years ago as the superintendent of schools in Union. And that he would be one of the descendants from that family. And in fact, that family also owned the funeral parlor that's now Loveland Funeral Parlor. At one time, and when I was a kid, that was Snodgrass's funeral parlor.
Hmm.
But
so
anyway, that's where
Orchard still there as well as the house?
No, the orchard's not there. There's still some bare field back in there, but there might be a few trees left, but I doubt it.
Does your family still own that?
No, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
The family, the last of the family owned it, and it was probably in the 1950s, maybe in the 60s. Somewhere along in there.
Well, let's go to 1935, and you have just moved to the orchard at Mount Glenn. Can you describe that experience?
Well, what I remember there is my dad borrowed, I think he must have borrowed the truck, I don't think he owned it, but it was a covered van. Today it'd probably be like a ton and a half truck that had a big box on the back of it, like a furniture store would deliver furniture with. Anyway, I think he must have borrowed that, because he had a rig, but I don't think that was his, and it was too big to deliver ice in. And he also delivered coal. He sold coal too, as well as ice in the 20s. They didn't make the ice business was only good for the summertime, so you had to do something in the winter, and he sold coal.
Where did you get the coal from?
You'd buy it in the railroad would bring it in carloads. And in fact, we're digressing, but it's kind of maybe we just well you can move things around later.
Yeah.
But anyway, the coal would come in a coal car. It'd be open on the top, and he did a lot of the shoveling, and his brother Johnny would help. It was in business with him. He worked for him, and they would hire other people, and they'd actually unload those cars by shoveling the coal out of the car. Mm-hmm. Now I think some of them they had the drops in the bottom, but that wouldn't get the car very empty, and they'd actually shovel tons and tons of coal by hand. And some of those they'd get lump coal, and some of those lumps would be, 20 inches across sometimes. And people would buy that and they'd break it up because it would be hard coal. It would usually be anthracite coal when it was big like that. And that's called, it's a hard coal, the way it is formed in the ground. It ends up being a lot more dense, anthracite does. Has a lot more energy per unit volume, but usually more expensive to buy. And then there's another kind they call bituminous coal, which was softer and not as dense and not as much energy per unit volume. Of course, priced accordingly. But anyway, they would unload those coal cars, and then they would deliver it, I think by horse and team and wagon, but mostly by then they had old model A trucks and this sort of thing, and they delivered around. And you can tell some houses today that would have had a coal furnace in the basement because of the location of a window in the house that would be located where they could actually put a chute into the basement, into the coal bin, and shovel the coal down into the basement. This house we're living in today here at 96 Penn Avenue actually had a coal furnace because I found chunks of coal in the basement when we moved here in 1968. So I knew, why that coal was in the basement, and I knew where the coal bin had to be.
Wow.
But that's how they kept the business going in the wintertime, was sell coal. Ice in the summer, coal in the winter. Mm. And they had wood too.
Sounds like a really physical, big, lot of physical labor.
Oh yeah, you were strong. My dad wasn't a big person. He was about 5'9", and I probably weighed 150 or 60 pounds in those days, but he was strong, and my uncle was shorter than he was. So you weren't so big as you were strong.
Mm-hmm.
And you kept it up by all this hardy work. That's how they kept the business going year-round, was to do those two things.
Wow.
Back in 1935, when we moved to the home in Mount Glenn, and I would have been not quite 4 years old yet, I guess, I would have been 3 years old in December of 35, so I guess I was not quite 3 years old. But I just remember, there's not much I remember in those days, except I remember him backing the truck up to the front porch and that there was some unloading that had to be done. And that's what impressed me, and that's what stayed with me. And I remember my brother, who had at that time been, about a year old or a little more, and my mother, all four of us in the cab of this truck. And in those days, those cabs weren't very big, but then two of us weren't very big either.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember backing up and getting unloaded. And I don't remember a lot. In the next few years, there's certain things you remember, but not a lot. I remember the fact that there were foxes up in the timber, and it was always a special treat in the early days for the kids, for Dale and I to get to go up and see the foxes and be around, but they were very careful about us not being in the fox pen, because they had sharp teeth, and they weren't friendly people. I mean, they're wild animals, essentially, that are caged up. And
so even the pups were probably pretty...
You didn't mess with them.
Mm-hmm.
Mother saw to that, that they didn't like humans. And they'd run and hide they had a fox, we call them fox boxes, I guess, but they were little buildings that were probably about 4 by 6 feet, and you could look down in them by raising the, had them hidden so you could raise the lid up and look down in on the litter and things. Mm-hmm. But usually the foxes would escape into that. They didn't want to mess with you either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they were, you know, they would have, they were, of course, came from the wild in early days, but I suppose by then, you know, they had probably been 40, 50 years and several generations from being in the wild, those mm-hmm. foxes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, do you remember the orchard starting to produce?
Well, some, you know, what you remember is that suddenly you start having fruit around. And so the orchard, they planted that orchard probably about 1933. And so about 5 years later, so 38, it would have been starting to produce a little bit. And I remember the cherry trees, which was the main commercial crop. We had apples and we had peaches and plums and apricots and pears. But the big commercial crop in later years, by the 1940s, was cherries. Although we had quite a few apples, but they never, it wasn't something that did that well out in Mount Glen, and there was too much competition from other areas that had better land and more irrigation for apples and bigger size and things, and not quite a long enough growing season for apples and the fall apples around here. But anyway, I remember, you know, you mostly sold some fruit locally. And we did peddling too. I remember going on peddling trips, which means you load up your vehicle with fruit and you take it out and you go down the street and knock on doors and ask them if they would like to buy any fruit. And in those days, people expected this because you didn't have much local fresh fruit or vegetables outside of what was grown locally. So it was a way for people to get fresh fruit and fresh vegetables, which for people to come around town and peddle them, or for you to know who grew them and put in an order. And you didn't have Saturday markets, for example, like you do today. But it's sort of a Saturday market on wheels, and each person going around town. But you would go to other communities. We'd go to Cove, or we might go to Union, or might go to North Powder. I remember going up to Starkey, and I remember going to Hillgard. I don't remember really going to Meacham or Camille, although I'm sure we did. Sort of followed the same route as my father did when he was a kid, because people were still buying their fruit and vegetables that way. But my family, mostly my dad as a kid and his father, and for myself as a kid and my father, mostly what we had was fruit. We didn't really sell much in the way of vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the cherries were the commercial crop, and that's the only thing we ever sold, what I call commercially, which means they were packed fresh in Embler. There was a packing house in Embler that at one time had packed fresh apples to ship out of this valley. But this valley, up until about in the 1920s, raised lots of apples. Embler area was just huge apple orchards, and they had packing plants over there. And Clayton Fox could tell you all kinds of stories. Somebody, I'm sure, has interviewed Clayton, and there's that. I'm sure that story's been recorded, but. We used that same packing house then to ship fresh cherries, and you would take your larger cherries and the ones that would ship. A variety called Bing and another variety called Lambert were the ones that we had in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Other varieties have been developed since then, but those are the two varieties you grew that could be shipped. The Bings were the larger of the two. They were a little firmer, they were a little sweeter. They actually shipped very, very nicely, but they didn't produce as heavy a crop and as much, and so you raised Lamberts too, which also were sent fresh, but they were a little softer, a little harder to ship them and have them arrive in good shape. Another variety in those days that was raised commercially was Royal Anns, and they were the light colored ones, and those were the ones that you would use for canning, and you could can the blacks too, but you can those, but also those are the cherries in the early days that were used for maraschino cherries. Because maraschino cherries, what you do is essentially take all of the color out of the cherry with a sulfur oxide kind of mixture and put it in the water and you soak them, you brine them. And it's not so much a salt brine as it is a sulfur oxide brine. You would essentially remove all the color, and so you essentially have something that's sort of off-white, sort of a creamy white color. There's nothing there but the shell, I mean the fiber. It's not just a shell, but it's the fiber of the cherry, and then you put it through a process to give it the color, red, and also the flavor, almond. So when you're eating a maraschino cherry, you don't have any of the original cherry there except the fiber. That's all, the cellulose material, and that's it. But that's still done today. But they would sell those, and those would sometimes, I guess, they actually bind them here. There was a big receiving plant also at Cove. That was a major cherry producing area and still is to this day. And there was Pumpkin Ridge area had a lot of orchards and cherries. And Embler was more apples. And then when apples kind of went out, then that's when the Embler area became more other kinds of farming, you know, whether it was grains or grasses or whatever.
Did you have pickers pick the cherries?
We hired the transient pickers to pick the cherries. There were always 10 or 12, 15 people locally that wanted to pick, and we'd hire them. And often those local people were women, and it was a summertime job, and they could bring their kids out, and they'd make some decent money, and it was kind of extra spending money for the family. They'd camp out at the orchard, and
in tents,
and then the whole family would be there, and they'd have a good time. It was sort of a 3-week-long picnic for them. But they were good workers, and they made decent money for those days because the kids, once they were like 8 or 9 years old, could help pick some. They played some, picked some. They picked down low, and then as they got older, they could climb the ladders. And then, but most of, you probably took off 90% of the crop was using professional cherry pickers. They were individuals that made a career of traveling the fruit season, and so they were individuals that were that had decided that was going to be what they would do instead of something else, and so they'd work in the fruit in California, move up into Oregon, move through Hood River in the Dalles and into La Grande and this valley, and in there would have been Melton Freewater and Yakima area, and then Flathead Lake up in Montana would have been the last of the season for them, and that'd be for cherries up there and some peaches and things. And then they'd head back down to the pears and apples in Medford, usually. And then some of them end up in Medford, in Hood River again. And eventually back down in California. And they actually made very good money. They often had their own trailer houses. They had pretty nice cars. They made good enough money that I remember one couple and their son actually wanted to buy out my folks' cherry orchard. And they could have afforded to do it. My folks didn't want to sell it, but those people, they lived a good life, and they could afford to buy what they needed and live quite comfortably, and maybe not even work for about 3 months in the wintertime.
Were they primarily Hispanic like they are today?
No, they were all, in fact, almost none of them were Hispanic like they are today. They were all Caucasians. You wouldn't have just mixed. A lot of them had come out of Oklahoma and the Dust Bowl area in the 30s, and because of the lack of work, it had moved west, and so they ended up usually in California and began working in the fruit industry as something to do, discovered they liked it, discovered they were successful at it, and continued to do it, but they had a route that they followed, and so there were pickers that came back 10, 12, 15 years in a row. And probably would have done it longer if it hadn't changed. And nowadays things are different. And you even pick, that some places are picking cherries by shaking the tree and gathering them that way, things like that.
So as you got into your early teens, were you picking or were you helping sort, or what was your...
Our role was really to help. We would pick in the variety fruit because we did all of our own. We didn't really hire help to pick an apple, or very little help to pick an apple, because we pretty much picked apples to sell locally, so we kind of picked them as we needed them, or to store for the winter. But we, mostly the family, our family, between my dad and my uncle and my brother Dale and myself, we picked that. Of course, Dale and I probably tried to get out of picking as much as we could. And we were in school when the pears and apples came on, so there wasn't much chance. But we'd help pick peaches, and we'd help pick apricots and plums and prunes, basically the plum. And by the way, a prune is really a plum that is low in moisture content. So when people want to argue about plums and prunes, everything is a plum. But prunes are really low moisture plums. And they do keep better and they haul better and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, technically they're all a plum. But anyway, we would pick those and we would usually try to leave them on the tree as much as we could. We tried to pick the riper ones first because we wanted to sell ripe fruit. That was part of the expectation, was people wanted tree ripened peaches. They didn't want green peaches that would ripen in the box.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to pick them. We'd pick a peach tree might get picked 8 or 10 times during the season, mm-hmm. to always be picking off the riper fruit. And the same way with apricots, although apricots tend to ripen more at the same time, but there's still some variation. Same way with plums, there's some variation, not a lot. Peaches, mm-hmm. are the big one. But we'd pick all of those ourselves, and then we'd sort them, and the people would come out, we'd call them when we had after the telephone, and they'd come out and pick them up, or we'd deliver them to their house. And a lot of them were sold that way. Lots of times, the peaches were all sold by orders, and never would have to peddle them.
Mm.
But sometimes we would peddle them because we had excess, and so we'd go to some place and drive around and try to sell them.
What do you remember about your school days?
Well, I started school in 1939 at Mount Glen School. It was a one-room country school, one teacher, pot-bellied stove that had this, was cast iron, but around it was this big metal protection device that probably was about, bottom of it was about a foot off the floor, and the top of it was probably about 6 feet off, 5 feet off the floor, so you couldn't burn yourself against the cast iron stove. The teacher's job was always to keep the stove, keep the stove going during the day. Usually there was a neighbor nearby that lived maybe a half a block or a block away, across the road, country road, gravel, would go over and build a fire in the morning before the teacher arrived, so it helped the teacher that way. But then the teacher's job was to keep the fire burning during the day. And this neighbor person who would agree to do it would also see, or other school board members and people would see, if the wood is, there's wood placed in the woodshed in the summertime or in the fall, and that it would be split and ready to be put in the stove. So, and then the kids, the bigger kids in the class would be expected to go out and bring in wood from the woodshed and put it in the wood box. And so in 1939, when I started school, there were probably about 10 or 12 kids in school. You got 8 grades, 12, and 12 kids. So, you know, there were grades when there were no children, and there were grades which might have 2. I don't know if there was ever 3 in a class. Probably a few times. But when I started school, I don't know if there was anybody else in my grade or not. There's one person that might have been. I just don't remember when he moved to that area. But it wasn't unusual to be in a grade by yourself. And everybody kind of listening on everybody else sometimes, and so you kind of learned at your own pace. And so teachers would be working with, if you're first grade and the teacher's working with third graders and you could understand it, you probably learned third grade things. And so you moved along at your own pace. And it was a good experience, a good education. I remember, and you helped each other. I remember as a third grader helping, well, I think the teacher made sure that I, as a third grader, felt like I was helping this eighth grader learn to read. And he was a person that was, you know, today we give them special education classes. Special education in those days was other kids helping them. And so I'm sure she made me feel good by the fact I could help an eighth grader, but I'm sure the eighth grader felt good because they were probably also helping the third grader learn to read too, you know. And so but that's how it kind of worked. Your teacher would have, you know, 8 grades to deal with, and maybe at least 6, I mean, at least 6 grades had kids in them. You had to have some things that were different, and there were the prescribed things you had to go through. There was a county school superintendent would come around and visit once in a while and check to see if progress was being made. And, of course, you always had your recesses, and we had the snake, there was a garter snake den in one corner of the schoolhouse, had a garter snake den in it, so you can conjure up all the stories that go with that, and probably I'd say yes, yeah, that happened. And and about an acre or an acre and a half schoolyard seemed awfully big, but I suppose if I measured today it wouldn't be. The schoolhouse is still there. It's pretty much, it's had a new roof put on it, so it's going to be salvaged, but the windows are all broken out and everything, but it's privately owned now. But and the land was given to the school district as long as it was used for school. Once it was no longer used for school, it reverted back to the owner. Mm-hmm. And so that family still owns that descendant of that family still owns that land and that building. You know, you had recesses and you played. And one interesting thing is, after the Second World War started, of course, everybody was expected to participate in some way to help the war effort. And of course, there were savings bonds, and so you're supposed to be buying savings stamps. And so every day at school, you're supposed to, not every day, but like once a week, you're supposed to bring your nickel or dime or whatever and buy a savings stamp if you could afford it. And the bonds, and then it'd work up if you had enough stamps to get a bond, and that would be issued in your name. But we also were expected to try to help in other ways, and one of them was collecting scrap iron. And so our school had in a scrap iron drive, and by then I'm going to guess that was like 1942 or 43. And so we had a scrap iron drive, and we went around to all the ranchers in the school district and asked them to donate any scrap iron they had that they didn't need. And of course, in those, you know, people would have worn out equipment and they'd just put it over in the corner. You drive around the valley now and you see a lot of scrap iron. It's old equipment just sitting there in the field, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we collected all of that and sold it. And we made, I don't know how much, but let's say we made $20. And there was, you got so much per pound. And maybe it was a penny a pound or what it was. But we made, you know, $20, $30 or something. But we made enough that we could buy a football for the school, and we could buy a baseball and a bat, and probably a few other athletic-related equipment, maybe a sort of a volleyball sort of thing, but we did sort of a kick for it and get a bite each office's team. And dodgeball, we played a lot of dodgeball, and so you wanted a softer one for that. But the district didn't have much money, so we raised the money to buy that. And today, I still have the football that we bought from that money in the basement here. And so it's one thing I was able to salvage after the school closed a few years. It was still down there. And my dad was on the school board and was chairman of the board many of those years. And so we were able to go get that football and save it. And we might have found one or two other things. I don't remember. I took my daughter back about 10, 15 years ago, and the chimney was still in there, and so we went inside, and so she got a brick out of the schoolhouse that her dad went to school in. But we would do, in math, for example, in school, we would do things that he drew, but little simple addition, subtraction, multiplication, division problems around the top of the board. And we'd put one person at one end and one person at the other, and you'd race to see who could get to the other end first. And it was the job of the rest of the class to check you. You'd say out loud, so this half of the class would check one person, this half of the class would check the other person, and so you'd race to see who gets the other end first. Then whoever won got to go against the next person that tried. And so when you got through, you had the champion for the day. Well, she'd leave those up there for a few weeks, but of course we'd pretty soon have them all memorized, and it was a question who could repeat it the fastest. And so then she put up a new set, but I